the theme for the afternoon talk is the doer and the non-doer. Just two or three months ago, I had the delight of being in Tiruvannamalai, a place in South India, well known for one of the great sages of India of the last century, Ramana Maharshi, who spent from his teenage years in Tiruvannamalai, staying at in a small ashram there at the foot of a rather lovely mountain called Arunachala. And Leela and Iran know the town and the ashram and the place very, very well. And between 1935 to 1939, one of the devotees who was at the ashram regularly kept a short report of some of the teachings of Ramana, and these were put into a book called Talks with Ramana. Some of you will have seen photographs of this rather lovely, saintly man, and I noticed Leela has on the cover of her, one of her books there. And Ramana refers a lot to, as the Buddha does, to this very important area and relationship of what it means to be a doer in the world and the great significance of the non-doing or the non-doer. And in the talk this afternoon, I'd like to address these two important areas of our life, see the practical implications and significance of that, and how both of them have a relationship to each other. So first, in other words, I'd like to look at the doer. When you and I look at the movement of our life, its unfoldment, its manifestation, there is a construct inside of us, which we call the self. And the self forms together, often and very frequently, as the doer. And in this movement of the doer, there is the engagement with the activity, the doing, and therefore, and also what is done. And this movement, backwards and forwards between the three, forms an important construct of our life. And what we notice again and again in its movement, how easily and frequently the doer is engaged in a measurement. And that measurement is an interpretation of the qualities of the doer. How good am I? How successful am I? The measurement of, am I doing it well or am I not doing it well? And of course applies here in the meditation hall. There is also the measurement of the doing itself. Is it working? Is it the best way or method? Do I need to be doing this? Applies here and applies in daily life. And the other measurement, which also and equally takes place, is in the relationship to the result. What is the outcome? And the kata, which is the doer, the Sanskrit, the karma, the action, the activity, and the karya, which is the result, these three areas really have a magnetic, and I mean this, magnetic grip on our life. We are infatuated and caught up with the doer, the doing, and the results or the outcome of what is done. And any inquiry into life, any serious investigation into life, just genuinely and unmistakably have to address this, because the self keeps the I, the me, its tendencies, its conditioning, keeps measuring the value of the doer, the value of what is being done, and the value of the outcome. And this has a very strong impact and influence on our behavior, on what we say, and what we do, where we go, what we put time and energy into. It's all this triple activity, the doer, the doing, and the done. And the teachings of the Buddha and the Ramana too a very strong encouragement for all of us to really take notice, because our clarity and our wisdom and in fact our peace of mind is very much tied up in all or one or two of these three areas there. What makes it harder, and you and I will know this, and this is to some degree shows how much we are dependent on authority figures here, I have to say. There is enormous pressure, and it's an obscene pressure, on men and women, young men and women as well as older ones, to be ambitious, to achieve, to get things done. And this ideology, and it's a brutal ideology, has been pumped into us from childhood, from education, into university, to the point that the way that we measure ourselves of how good we are is through how much we have matched up to the expectations and the demands that have been made upon us. And that we hardly realize it, how much as human beings we haven't really looked deeply into ourselves, but what we have done again and again is actually to submit to authority, wherever it might be. And we have been told, because we weren't born with this, as I mentioned, we have been told, you should be doing something with your life. It's a merciless mantra. And when we've internalized that, the sense of self-worth is significantly affected. And what happens in the kind of culture that we live in, we are constantly comparing ourselves with others. And we are constantly feeling, whatever age we are at, that others, whoever these others, mysterious others are much better off than I am. And then the subsequent mantra is, they, whoever they are, seem to have done so much more than I have done. They have achieved so much. They have made so much money. They've got such position. They've got such a nice car. They go to the dreaded Goa for their holidays, or whatever it might be. It's not so dreadful, but you know what I mean. So the doer, in this, tends to feel easily, I haven't done enough. And even when one has quote-unquote succeeded, the doer has got what she or he wants. The doer doesn't know how to rest. It's not possible. The doer doesn't know rest, doesn't know peace of mind, doesn't know anything else but doing. And some men and women are working so hard, that means feeding the doer with the doing to achieve particular objectives and results and achievement, that much else which is important in life really gets neglected, like love, human relationships, time for the nature, care and sensitivity, the sense of presence, and the whole world, shall we say, of the non-doing, which I'll talk about in a little while. So there we are in this construction of the doer, intensely conditioned by the society, which is the system which we live under, and we're bound in that, and as I said earlier on, the dependency on the result is extraordinarily high for the doer. And when we get what we want, we've really worked hard, we've got a good job, a good position, we've got the PhD, now we've got more letters to go with our name because we didn't have enough to go with them in the first place. we've got all of that. And then we've got the job that we desperately wanted or whatever. But the mind can't rest, because the doer doesn't know rest. It's not in the makeup of the doer. So even when something is achieved, and there is some relief for the doer, God, I got what I really wanted. That as soon as the relief is finished, the relief from the doing, the relief from the studying, the relief from the striving, as soon as the relief is finished, the doer is back. And if you've been successful, it can be back with a vengeance. Because based on the success can be, wow. And then one will move and drive even further and further. And we easily are in the grip of this. And if we're not, we actually madly are jealous and envy of those who are working neurotically. They must be really doing something important in their life. They are. They're driving themselves mad and others. So something in this system, of which there's very little choice about, though it's covered up with the language of choice, puts us under enormous pressure, and in the result, in the outcome of the activity which takes place, one needs in life to be as vigilant and as careful with what one interprets as success, as much as one interprets as failure. Because on the back of success, the self can grab hold of it, as I say, and the doer gets stronger. And for those who have a great interest in money, and there are a few around, far too many, that the comparing is notorious. And so if someone has made a million euros, how many shekels would that be? 5 million shekels, Lila tells us. Made 5 million shekels. It's well known that somebody who has made 5 million shekels is actually envious of somebody who has made 10 million shekels. So they still feel poor. The feeling, I still haven't got enough, because if I had 10 million shekels, wow, look what I could do with that. And once that 10 million shekel line has reached, they think, God, no, people have got 20 million shekels. Think what I could do with 20 million shekels. And so the movement of the doer is not alone, is not in a state of isolation, but actually is in constant comparison, constant competitiveness. It is hardly an intelligent way to live. And when we take it out of the marketplace, and you've seen all the corruption of it, how rotten the whole system is, the capitalism, but I try not to ramble on about it. I'll keep to the cushion. Not easy. That even when we move out of the marketplace and we come into a different kind of environment, still the same occurs. There is, oh, I'm going on a retreat. I'm going to do a retreat with so-and-so. And sometimes one notices that some of you have a wealth of experience, not only in environments such as this, but various other programs and projects and workshops and retreats and methods and practices. And I do think it's vital and precious to be able to explore. I don't think it's useful just to tie people down to the same old boring method and technique. This is religious fascism, confining people to the same thing. It is important to explore. Yet in the diversity of the forms, the methods, the techniques, the teachers, the teachings, the traditions, East and West, we want to look at, well, in all of those differences and similarities, what are some of the things which are in common? And one is the self, the condition of the I, the condition of me, the condition of mind. And when in the movement of the inner life, we outer or inwardly, this, the doer, the doing, and the done, and the measurement, just as it happens in daily life, it happens on the meditation cushion. It happens walking and standing and eating. And in that, the judgments and the interpretations not only happen with oneself, but it wouldn't be so bad if we just say, well, I'm just sitting and I'm judging myself. No. Every poor sod in the hall is being judged. He walks too fast, she eats too much, she's snoring, he's fidgeting, he's breathing like an elephant, or what? Whatever it might be. So, the view and the measuring and the judgment, they just burst out of the mind and looking for somebody to land on. One's fed up with it all landing on oneself. Someone is looking for a victim, someone who can just take one's stuff. Poor person quietly going about their day has no idea of the amount which is being projected upon them. You know, the way they dress, the way they walk, the way they sit, the way they get up in the morning, the way they brush their teeth, you know, the colour of their meditation cushion, I mean, it's all wrong. And so when the doer and the doing and what is being done, there is dissatisfaction. When the doer and the doing and what is done is generating dissatisfaction, the dissatisfaction will run everywhere. Sometimes it lands on one person who for the entire days of the retreat has been picked out as the worst person ever to have been born on earth. That there has to have been some evolutionary error that this person should appear. And just when I'm on a retreat, and if she and he hadn't appeared, I know I'd be totally enlightened by now. They're a complete obstruction to reality. So the mind in its movement, in its dissatisfaction with the doer, the doing and the done, can't hold it within the frame. It can't be clear in the box of it. It is a box and a small box. So it spills over onto others. And therefore, more often than not, it's saying a lot about ourselves and maybe a little and sometimes nothing about the others. We haven't realized the confinement in which we live. And the second same expresses itself in the outer world. That sometimes we pick on a person in the public life and we give this person some real importance, some real self-existence. And we attribute all success and failure, all good and bad, all right and wrong, to this person or persons or group. But all of us, and no matter who it is we pick out in this world, is only made up of all the conditions that make the person up, all the circumstances. Look at all the events that have made up your life and my life. Countless numbers of them. And even when there is change, we sometimes switch, and we just switch from negativity to positivity, positivity to negativity. We want to catch all of this, to see if we can look in another way. And just a small, rather a good example of this. In December, after the general elections in the United States, there was a major environmental meeting in Europe. And no, sorry, in late January. And the French ambassador at this major meeting, they were talking about the change in the new president. And he told a joke, rather unusual with embassy. And he said, a man went to knock on the front door of the White House and said, can I speak to George Bush, please? And the man who answered the door said, George Bush has gone. And he left. The next day, the man came back again, knocked on the door of the White House, and said, look, can I speak to George Bush, please? And he said, look, I've told you, he's gone. The third day, the same man comes back, he knocks on the door of the White House. He said, can I speak to George Bush, please? The man said, I've told you already, he's gone. And the visitor who knocked on the door said, I just love hearing you say that. And plenty of us, me included, have a certain relief in the change of the regime there. But very, very easily we shift from the negativity to the positivity, etc. But the positivity can switch very quickly to negativity. This is the movement of projection, the layers upon. And we need in life, as I say, to look inwardly and outwardly, to see what layers we are laying upon the world. What is our mind doing? In what way is it painting the world? And in that painting of the world, perhaps it says, as I mentioned, more about us, not realizing the amount of projection and assuming that the projection is a statement of the reality. And one important feature in this, a very important one, as I've mentioned a couple of times already, this tends to happen in a place of dissatisfaction. When we are not content, when we are not clear, when there's that movement in which there's the loss of the clarity, projection is much more likely to arise. When we are not happy, we tend to dump. And therefore, the act of looking within and the response, taking the responsibility for what we experience within, is a mature way of looking at the world, simply because in that we learn to take responsibility. And in the learning to take responsibility, there will be much less dumping. Whatever. In the posture, the sitting, walking, the standing, and the reclining postures there. If in the doer, I'm doing some meditation, now I'm doing my walking period, now I'm doing my sitting period, or whatever. In the doer, if there is the dependency on the result, it will indicate to us, we get agitated, we get high, it's working, it's not working, as I mentioned. One of the factors that disrupt the peace of mind is that the doer is under the influence of the past. When there is the dependency on the result, and lots of views and opinions coming around about the result, the tendency from the past is having an influence. And we fail to see this, and we say, no, the effect is causing me to be like this. The effect is having some influence. But the influence of the past on the moment, on the doer, is the bigger influence. If the effect, the result, the outcome of events really was that which affected us, then every time that event happened, whoever, exactly the same outcome would be. But we know that's not true. We know some people are able to handle a result, an outcome, the effect of something, the fruit of something, and handle it incredibly well. Wow. That person has just received some incredibly painful information. That person is engaged in a really tough job. That person has just had some devastating news, the loss of a loved one. And we look, and sometimes we just, wow, the capacity of women and men to handle incredibly difficult situations. We're armed to such people. Why? Because there's a clarity there, an awareness of outcome, without a pressure of the tendency, or Buddhist language, a karma of the old past, which is falling on top of it as well. And sometimes we see people, and even on the smallest little thing, the tiniest little thing, it becomes a huge drama. And there are a lot of drama queens and kings out there. We're looking for Dharma kings and queens. We've got drama. It's a great pity. And that isn't telling us too much about the outcome. The outcome of events in life do not cause our unhappiness. It's just that we don't know ourselves in relationship to outcome well enough. And even with outcome, all sorts of outcome, the outcome we can't construct. I can't make an outcome. I can't even safely predict one. The factors which bring about an outcome are multiple. You're going to work. There's a tendency. The tendency is, I got to get to work on time. I'm going to be late. One is driving fast. And one's half asleep. You hit the rear end of the car in front, which doesn't make that person's day. Now you're really late. You have to stop the car. The other car has stopped. He or she has got out the car, breathing fire. There's a little twist in the metal. Oh, tragic. And the agitation, the anger, and the exchange of information, the insurance policies, etc., etc. So, from one movement called, I have to hurry to get to work, and the result is, I really want to get to work. And therefore, there is the doer, which is called driving quickly in this case, the hurrying to get to work. And in that movement of the doer, the doing, the driving, and getting it done and over with, there is, as the Buddha pointed out, unintended outcomes. We've all known them. Unintended outcomes. And in the unintended outcome, numerous factors, including our state of mind, contribute to it. Some of us, like myself, don't own a car. One starts a relationship. Some people do it on retreats. Fall madly, badly, sadly in love with somebody. Very, very sweet. And then sometimes you hear, I love this New Age mantra, follow your heart. Have you heard it? You've probably heard it. My God. If some people just followed their heart, frankly, they would spend most of their life in bed. I think you get what I mean. So sometimes We follow the heart with wholesomeness, with care, with respect, with love there. And sometimes she or he follows her or his heart. Then there is a meeting point. And in meeting point, there is love and there is intimacy. And there is tremendous enjoyment of being together. And one can't bear a day going by without some kind of phone call or contact or email or text, from which all the mobile phone companies depend for their survival. And all of that. And love and passion, they're making love, and the phone can be ringing morning, noon and night, but when making love with the person across the table, one's not even going to get up and answer the phone. It's, love is in the foreground, marvelous, wonderful. And then this heavenly experience, living in the Garden of Eden, enjoying the kingdom of heaven of love and passion. And then a little bit of the humanness of the other person or oneself starts to emerge. Perhaps they start talking about the Bible. Forgive me, wicked. Or football, even worse. Or whatever it might be. Or they've got some odd peculiar habits. Or they say, I'm rather busy. Or I need some space. Or I need more time with you. And you feel the pressure, etc. And other things start to happen, etc. So it starts off amazing. Phenomenal. The love of my life. Love of my life. Wait a minute. And time goes by. Not all bad news, but just hang in. Time goes by. And as the Buddha said, from the action, from the movement, there can be unintended outcomes. Wow. It went from pure heaven to hell. Total hell. Years of recovery. Therapists are employed on it, aren't they? Right. Etc. So when we engage with life, when there's the participation in it, there's risk. And one of the risks that you and I have to be clear about in the risk, that even with well-intentioned activity, there is no guarantee of complete, wonderful happiness and peace of mind as the outcome. That's the risk. Driving the car, falling in love, starting a wonderful job, entering into a course of studies, traveling to India, whatever it might be. Life has within its movement of the doer, the doing and the done, a tremendous unpredictable. We cannot organize our life to fit in with our will. Hard truth. We cannot organize our life to fit in with our will. And if we don't get clear about this, whoa, life is going to go slap us around everywhere. So when we're on the meditation cushion, when we're walking mindfully and slowly up and down, when we're just engaging in the standing meditation, to some degree, not completely and not purely, shall we say, but to some degree, we're dropping the doer. There's much less doing going on. In a way, meditation is the kind of classic archetype of non-doing in its best sense. So that when you and I are sitting totally still, and again, there's no ideology of here of encouraging people to take vows of not moving. I regard this as fascist imposition on people. But just sometimes, some moments, there is a natural silence and stillness which takes place. And you and I know in those periods and moments, might be a few minutes, or 10 minutes, or 20 minutes, or whatever time, that even to move our little finger feels like doing too much. And we just move our little finger and I think, what? I didn't mean to do that. Or whatever, we're just sitting there and suddenly our hands are, etc. So the non-doing experience, when we have those moments of just the mindful walking up and down, or just the standing or the sitting, those non-doing experiences are greatly appreciated. The thought can arise in just sitting in silence and presence and stillness. And at the end of the sitting, because of the non-doing and just presence, the thought can arise, this was a lovely sitting. It's an appreciation of the non-doer. It's an appreciation, not so much about me and what I do, but it's an appreciation for the silence. It's appreciation for a precious element of stillness. It's appreciation for just being. And in that appreciation, and in that recognition of and acknowledgement there, two things are rather beautiful about it. One is, one doesn't feel under the pressure of the past. The pressure of the past generates the doer and the measuring. One also, in the moment, is not demanding anything from anybody else. There is no pressure on life. No pressure to get something, to want something, to have something. And even though there is no pressure from the past to do, nor is there a demand on the world for something, from someone or a situation or money or job or whatever, something is fulfilling about it. Something can feel nourishing about it. And it's got nothing to do with my past, because I don't feel it under the pressure in those moments. And it's got nothing to do with what's out there. Yet I don't feel dull or numb or lost. I feel clear. I feel silent. I feel a certain stillness, and I feel a certain fulfillment. I feel nourished. I think this is a lovely sitting, a lovely meditation. What a joy it is just to rest in the moment. And it seems that when we lose access to that, we kind of lose the sense of that, and how very easily the tendency comes back. There is a feeling of lack. We feel driven and compelled, and we're trying to get to some sense of feeling complete through what we do, through getting some particular goal. Fulfillment is not in running after the personal goal. One could listen to that and think, what are you saying, Christopher? We should just spend the rest of our life sitting on our ass and having some nice food at lunch? Actually, not a bad idea. No, what it means is that the non-doer, just the walking, but not really doing anything in terms of I've got somewhere to go. It's just the walking. Just the standing. Not standing waiting for the restaurant doors to open, or standing in the queue to get some stamps from the post office, but just the standing, just the reclining, that the experience of that and the intimacy with it and the steadiness with it mean that you and I can engage remarkably fully with life, fully committed to it, fully engaged in it. No dependency on the measurement of the doer, no dependency on the doing, and no dependency for happiness on the result. That's the difference. And it's a huge difference. A huge difference. We can still engage in business. We can still engage in service to others. We can still engage in study. We can still engage in travels. We can still develop our relationships. We can still be committed to action and meeting with the world. Totally. But we know something. We know that the real happiness and the real joy of life is not found in the doer. And it's not found in getting what we want. Because getting what we want is dependent on too many conditions, as the example that I gave. And some of the big conditions, of course, is the cooperation of others. And sometimes people don't cooperate. Someone said to me here, "Oh, Christopher, I see people here, they do things that really upset me. And they drop this, make this noise, and they do this, and they do this, etc. And they're not keeping to the rules. What rules? They're not keeping to the rules, not keeping to the agreements, all this chatter that goes on." My response is, "Do you know how many retreats I've been on? Hundreds, thousands. Every day, I see 1,000 things which could be different. Every day. Must do. You live in this world of people's states of mind. That's why they live in a world of states of mind. And if my peace of mind and happiness is dependent on what I do, which means it's dependent on you. Oh, God help me. I would be crawling into a retreat and would be carried out on a stretcher. If the teacher is dependent on what is done and is dependent on the outcome, and the outcome is dependent on you. Can't live like that. So somewhere in the love of the non-doing, in the recognition of the simple function, shall we say, the doer, the doing, and the done, and hopefully the love which is there, that the trust in the love, the trust in the expression is more potent and authentic and staying true to it than the teacher, the teaching, and the taught. If I'm reliant on, "Oh, did I give a good talk? Do they understand me? Am I appreciated? Oh, what, oh, they didn't like that. Oh my God, I can't sleep at night," or whatever. If I live in that world, it's exhausting. But if I say, this is a convenience, the role, the doing, and what is done. One appreciates and acknowledges it, but deep down, there's something else about the non-doing, about presence, about love, which carries it. And out of that comes loads, bucket loads of happiness. Living in ambition, and living in those three, doing, doing, and done. So we take time out while we're here to reconnect, to stop and to be silent, to feel present. And please, with the silence, it's such an enormous support. It is the act of love here for everybody, just to allow others to be in their silence. And in the silence, which gives so much support to each other, out of that silence, we can get a clear and balanced perspective of the doer. And if we get that clear with us, there's a great liberation. It's a great freedom in life. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings love non-doing. May all beings approach action in the world with wisdom and love. Time 5 o'clock. And some groups at this time, some standing meditation. 5:30 is sitting until the tea time. Thank you.